From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be. Across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Well, now listen to this story. There's a recall of more products. You may have this on your shelf. I want you to know about it. A company that sold some 80,000 tubes of toothpaste containing a poisonous ingredient has pleaded no contest to violating California's health and safety code. The Los Angeles City Attorney says Selective Imports pleaded no contest to a misdemeanor and will donate $33,000 to charity. That's not a lot of money. The second company involved is called Vernon Sales, and they agreed last fall to pay $10,000 to charity. Selective Imports sold to distributors nationwide a Chinese toothpaste called Cool Dent that contained a potentially harmful chemical called diethylene glycol. Vernon Sales was also accused of distributing some of this stuff in Los Angeles. No illnesses were reported, but most of the toothpaste is still unaccounted for. A recall remains in effect. Cool Dent. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger of California declared a state of emergency because of 3 years of below-average rain and snowfall in the state, a step that urges urban water agencies now to reduce water use by 20%. Mandatory rationing is an option if the declaration and other measures become insufficient. Agriculture losses, they say, could reach $2.8 billion this year and cost 95,000 jobs in the state. In Illinois, a 58-year-old Walmart employee who said he just couldn't take it anymore lit himself on fire in a parking lot where he worked and was later pronounced dead at a hospital. His son said his father went to work last night with nothing seemingly out of control or of the ordinary. He said this has nothing to do with the economy. I want to make that clear. And he added that the family may never know the reason for the public suicide. The man who worked the overnight shift was in a parking lot of an adjacent sporting goods store when he set himself on fire with liquid fluid with witnesses around him.
And now, here's Johnny!
Ah, yes, that's the voice of Ed McMahon. He was a guest on Coast to Coast some time ago, as a matter of fact. Former sidekick to Johnny Carson on Tonight and a familiar television pitchman for commercials, he is hospitalized now in intensive care, and a person very close to him said that Ed McMahon has bone cancer. 85 years old, Ed McMahon has been hospitalized for several weeks for treatment of pneumonia and other ailments as well. McMahon's wife and family are with him and appreciate the public expressions of concern. He had a broken neck in a fall in 2007. He faced foreclosure on his home last year because he said the injury left him unable to work, but a deal was announced last December that allowed him to stay in the house. McMahon was Johnny Carson's announcer and second banana on Tonight from 1962 until Carson's retirement in 1992, introducing him with a resounding, "Here's Johnny," as you heard, and bolstering the host with hearty laughs. Johnny Carson, by the way, died in 2005. Another sad story tonight in Grand Rapids, Michigan. News Radio Wood 1300, our affiliate there, has lost a very valued member of its family. Rick Beckett, the co-host of the Rick and Scott Show, passed away. He suffered a heart attack. News Radio Wood 1300 is planning a special tribute program to Rick Beckett and his family, celebrating his life and career Monday, March 2nd, from 9 a.m. to noon. Rick Beckett was 54. He would have been 55 on June 30th of this year. Supporters of programs to provide legal marijuana to patients with painful medical conditions are celebrating tonight as Attorney General Eric Holder's statement this week that the DEA would end its raids on state-approved marijuana dispensaries that had been going on. They will stop doing that. A businessman who lost his mobile phone on a beach was amazed when it turned up in the belly of a giant cod. Andrew Cheadle thought it had been swept out to sea after it slipped from his pocket. But a week later, his girlfriend's mobile phone rang, and there was a fisherman on the other line, Glenn Curley, saying, "Hey, I found a phone and a 25-pound fish." Well, Andrew got the phone back, dried it out, and it still works. You know, the argument has been made that Thomas Edison was working on a ghost communication device, a ghost box of sorts, to contact the dead. However, there are many Edison experts that argue that it was only a legend, a myth that just wasn't true. Whatever the truth behind Edison, we talk about EVPs, and that brings us to the latest development of the ghost box. We've talked about the SpiritCom before, and we've also talked about Frank's box, truly the first of its kind. Frank's box is a ghost box that produces random voltage to create raw audio from an AM tuner, where it is then amplified and then fed into an echo chamber, developed by Frank Simpson. He's the original inventor of the ghost box. In a moment, Rosemary Ellen Guiley joins us. She has the latest version. We'll talk with her in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, a leading expert on the unusual, the paranormal. Rosemary has researched, investigated, and written about paranormal since 1983. Her extensive field work investigated hauntings, mysterious and sacred places, makes her definitely a leading expert in the field. Regular guest here on Coast to Coast. She writes a column for Taps Para Magazine and is a consulting editor for Fate Magazine as well. She continues to research angels, demons, ghosts, spirits. We're going to talk about dreams with her later on tonight as well. Here she is in the studio, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Hey, how are you?
I'm doing great, George. It's exciting to be back in the studio. It's exciting to be back in L.A.
Likewise. What brings you to L.A., can you say? Or are you on a secret project?
Well, I certainly can say it was an exciting day. I was working with Amity Pictures to do some extras for the brand new boxed DVD set of the hit show Supernatural. And I'm going to be featured in a Dante's Inferno roadmap of the paranormal that they're putting together for the features of Heaven, Hell, and Purgatory. We had a really great session talking about angels, demons, levels of heaven and hell, the war between ultimate good and evil. It's quite exciting because that show is really great, how they handle the paranormal material, and I'm excited to be part of the DVD set. That'll be out in August.
They didn't dress you up like a devil, did they?
No, I'm afraid I look pretty ordinary.
You're not in red today. You're in pink. Rosemary, it's good to have you in the studio, too, by the way.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
To a lot of people who don't know you, you started as a guest with me back in my early St. Louis days. And this is a great story, because when I was doing my late-night talk show in St. Louis, and generally producing it all by myself, later on they gave me a producer. I guess they figured they were going to keep me around. I started doing as much research as I can in terms of getting some different guests on the show. And I would go to bookstores and I would look in the various sections of things. And I wanted to do a show on dreams. And I found your book, The Encyclopedia of Dreams. And I said, I've got to get Rosemary Ellen Guiley on the show. And we did. We made that first call to you, and that was back in 1997. Can you believe that?
Time flies. It's amazing.
And folks in St. Louis just loved you, and we'll do that a little bit later on. We'll talk about dreams next hour and maybe take some dream calls later on. But that's how it started. And you've been a regular contributor now to Coast as well with the various things you've done, including witches and hauntings and angels and everything else. You're very prolific.
41 books and counting. Encyclopedia of Demons will be out this year. I'm organizing some new projects. My young adult series is going well. I still have some to finish up on that. We've got 17 in the launch last year and this
good
year.
For you.
And I'm going to be revising my Encyclopedia of Vampires and Werewolves for a second edition, talking about some new encyclopedias.
We're going to add
and
Tom
some secret,
to that, right?
Right. He's going to be the headline vampire.
Yes, he will. How did
and,
you? How did you get
some other great
though?
Projects?
What,
that got, we'll
what got you into the paranormal end?
Childhood experiences, like a lot of people,
like me, and like everybody.
I think most kids have at least a few experiences, and if their parents tell them to stop imagining things and talking that way, they go quiet about it and eventually forget about the experiences. For me, they were very much at the forefront because I was totally fascinated by the occult and sci-fi, fantasy, astronomy, horror. And also other members of my family had psychic experiences. And so that drew me into this world more. I was fascinated by it. And how did it work? And what sorts of strange things could you experience, and were they real, and why did some people have these experiences and other people not? So that was the beginning of my journey.
Tonight we're going to listen to several clips this hour on EVP sounds that Rosemary has provided to us. Rosemary, well over a year ago, we were talking about Frank's box. And,
in the studio.
He continues to make new ones, and you've got one. He built one for you. What's the difference between an old Frank's box and a new one?
I think the most significant difference is literally Frank's mojo. Every box is different because he makes them out of parts that he can find. He gets inspirations. He has different wiring. He experiments around with echo chambers and tuners, different kinds of tuners. And so every box is unique unto itself. No two are alike. I have number 45 now. A couple of years ago, I got 21 and 22. And
you're going the wrong way.
he's working on some new ones now. I think he's up to 48, but they're not operational yet. But 45 is the newest one off the Frank assembly line. And I will be taking it out into the field for the first time in April. I'm going to participate in what I hope is going to be a very interesting research trip into the Bridgewater Triangle area in Massachusetts.
Sure,
to
yeah.
King Philip's Cave. And we'll be trying it out there. I'll be working with a group of researchers from up that way.
If you go to coasttocoastam.com, you'll see some pictures that Rosemary has supplied us. You'll take a look at Frank's box. It looks huge. It's not that big, is it?
They're not that big, and some of them actually are quite small. It depends on the casing that Frank uses, and he's experimented with wood casings, plastic casings. Some of them are about the size of, a small radio, and the first two that I got, 21 and 22, are quite sizable, about almost 12 inches by 12
are they
inches
heavy?
Plywood box. They're not heavy, no, because what's inside is mostly wires and radio parts, car stereo parts. What accounts for the size in some of them is the echo chamber. And now I sent number 22 back to Frank for his retuning. And it seems that over time they kind of, and perhaps with wear and movement and that sort of thing, they lose some of their sensitivity and have to be reduced again.
Yeah.
So, and now what he's done with number 22 is I can now run it off electricity instead of just batteries. The batteries go fast. If it's battery operated only, they go pretty fast.
Apparently, he got the idea of making this from a fellow by the name of Stefan Bion. Is that true? A long time ago, he spotted an article in 1995 in Popular Electronics magazine, and he started fiddling around with this.
Like a lot of people with electrical engineering and ham radio operator backgrounds do, Frank got interested in EVP. And he's like a lot of people who tinker around with inventing these devices. You get inspiration from somewhere. And some inspiration came through on EVPs for things that he could do to improve devices.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been pretty characteristic of the history of EVP and ITC, instrumental transcommunications, is that you start getting ideas and thoughts and messages from something that seems to be not of this world.
What is your take on EVPs? What do you think they are?
We have absolutely no way to prove who they say they are. Are we really talking to the dead? Are we really talking to entities from other dimensions? My own experience demonstrates to me that there are no explanations for all of the things that come across. I've recorded quite a few things that I can't explain in terms of like a stray radio signal or, you know, picking up a phone conversation or something like that. Are they really dead people? I think that theoretically it's possible to communicate with the dead and also with other entities.
Sure.
But we can't yet have sustained conversation. And so there's a lot of controversy, and I'll be one of the first to admit that this is an area that's very easy for skeptics to have a field day with, because it is highly subjective and very erratic and unreliable. You never know what you're going to get. I personally don't believe that we have the technology to reliably dial up specific people or entities on demand.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of get what you get. And sometimes you get a lot and sometimes you get very little.
Well, you know, I always would think, why can't we just hear ghost sounds as opposed to getting it on a digital recording or on a Frank's box or a spirit comm? And then it dawned on me, of course, radio. I can't hear radio with my ears. I need a radio to hear radio, actually. You just don't hear the transmissions with the ear. So I guess the same could be said about EVPs.
Absolutely, George. There needs to be some sort of interface, a translating sort of interface that enables something from a non-physical realm to manifest physical sounds and other phenomena in our environment.
Rosemary, we're going to listen the next half hour to some of these EVP sounds that you've supplied for us, and I'll have you set that up too and tell us the stories behind that. What does modern science say about EVPs, if anything?
Modern science says very little. Because it is so controversial, and there's really no way to validate or prove or test what you get. You can go back to the same place and record and never get exactly the same thing. A typical EVP, a typical clip, is just a few seconds in length. And asking questions, trying to get the same communicator to continue providing information is very unusual. You might get one or two comments from a particular voice, and then that's it. My personal feeling is that these communication bridges are very difficult to build and maintain, and we are in the process of trying to discover the technology, and this technology is consciousness technology as well as actual machines and devices. We need to find the right formula where we can open up these links and sustain them so that we can have like a regular conversation that you might have with a living person on a cell phone. But science really dismisses this as highly speculative territory.
Why do most of these EVP sounds seem violent? They seem to be coming from entities, if they are entities, that died violently. Something has happened to them.
I think that the negative emotions generated by violence seem to impress something in our physical space more readily than happy emotions. There's an intensity there that seems to carry across into the ether, so to speak, and we can more readily pick up on that than happy things. And that applies to hauntings as well. The majority of hauntings that are strong and have a lot of dramatic phenomena to them concern unhappy events, suicides, murders, accidents, arguments, places where battles were fought and lots of people died. And we don't have that many hauntings, for example, of weddings and birthday parties and, you know, people just enjoying themselves and being happy. So it's the intensity of the emotion, I think, that makes the difference, and negativity has a more powerful punch.
Well, there's no question, Rosemary, that something is coming through these ghost boxes. The question is, what the heck are they?
I ask that question all the time, and as I mentioned earlier, I get these results where I can't explain them. I can't explain why I hear my own name come back, why a communicator identifies me as an author and says my name. It's very hard to explain that away in terms of a picking up a random snippet on a radio show. Obviously, I'm at the same time not on a radio show, and what are the odds that someone would be playing a tape that I would happen to pick up in that location? But these sorts of things happen. Clearly, we are communicating with something, but what? Are they trickster entities? The argument is made by some people that
Could that be demons? You mean
that
tricksters?
Demons could be masquerading as the dead, just trying to fool around with us, or maybe we are really talking to the dead.
Maybe it's a portal for them. Is that possible?
I think that they're is some sort of subtle energy field that's generated in the operation of these. This is a combination of the consciousness of the people using the device and witnessing the event, as well as the device itself. I don't think that it's just machine. It has to be something more than that. And there's some sort of subtle energy that we don't understand yet that enables these portals to open and the impressions to be made in our environment. I have noticed that running these devices frequently attracts shadow people. And I've had some cases where shadow people have begun manifesting in the environment while the box is operating.
We'll be back in a moment with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. We'll play some EVP clips as well right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, you get a double dip of Ian Punnett this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And let's go peek in on Ian right now. Where are you?
Hey, George, I didn't know I was doing both this weekend. Am I?
They've got you down.
Do they really? Okay, well, I'll make sure that happens.
I think.
Okay. Well, if I get a chance, I'll do it. All I know for sure is what's coming up on Saturday night on Coast to Coast, and that is, were you of the era?
No.
Where they?
No. I'm looking at the wrong. I'm doing it this Sunday.
That's what I thought.
I'm tricking you.
That's what I thought, but
I wanted to tell you what my schedule is. By the way, I've got to be in Vancouver tomorrow morning.
Doing what?
I've got a major conference and a live program I'm doing for our affiliate, 1410, out there in Vancouver, British Columbia.
That's great.
But then I'm getting on a plane early Sunday to get here to do the show. And I just wanted you to kind of be aware of that in case it snows and I'm stuck in Vancouver.
In case the skiing is really good?
I'm not skiing.
Just
stand by just in case.
I'll stand by for you.
That's what I meant. But you're on tomorrow, so what do we got?
I'll stand by for you easy on Sunday night. And Saturday night's really cool. Did you ever have to go through that thing where if you were left-handed, they forced you to write with your right hand when you were growing up?
No, I never had to do that.
You know, kids who did that? My brother did that, where he was the schools thought it was wrong for there to be left-handed people. Well, there was a whole movement there for a long time, too, about height. And this book, Tomorrow Night, is a really scary investigation into a time when it was standard to mess with the hormones of kids if boys were too short or girls were too tall, to try to get them to be normal.
Normal is,
exactly.
I guess.
And doctors were unabashedly messing with kids' pituitary glands, trying to manipulate hormones at an age before they even really understood what they were doing, all because they thought it was wrong for girls to be, for example, to be too tall was to be accursed, that they would never find anybody. And so parents were willingly giving their kids up to these experiments, and these guests tomorrow night have tracked down many of these living experiments. How did it work out? Whatever happened to these bodies? And in some cases, did everybody even survive to tell about it?
Well, that'll be a great show. And then just kind of like sit around Sunday, okay, just in case.
I will. Hey, have a great time in Vancouver.
Okay, my friend.
Thank you, Steve.
That's Ian Punnett. And my guest on Sunday will be Peter Cochran as we talk with him about thinking outside of the box. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Rosemary, let's listen in on these four EVP sounds, but I want you to set them up for us, how they were obtained, where they were obtained. What do we have here?
I believe that first we're going to go to the Lincoln Theater in Decatur, Illinois. I have been there for conferences and investigations. Troy Taylor has an annual American Ghost Society conference there. And last summer I was there with Frank's Boxes devices, demonstrating them, and did some investigation in the theater, which is quite haunted at night. And with me was Joey Tito, who is a paranormal investigator from Chicago, the Ghost Research Society. He's also their videographer. And he photographed me, or rather videotaped me, in infrared using the box in different areas of the theater. And we got some interesting recordings. In one of the clips, I ask, is there anyone communicating who knows anyone in the theater? And male and female voices say that they know somebody named Joey. And verify this, and I say, there is a Joey in the theater. Is that him? And they say, yes, that's him, that's him. And in another area of the theater, I again ask who's present, who would like to communicate, and do they know anyone present? And a female voice, who identifies herself as Rachel, says that she is present because of the author, Rosemary.
Now, with EVPs, very difficult to hear, especially going through the radio into your radio. Let's listen in on this first one.
I would like to ask a question. Someone said I'm here. Who's here? Rachel? Rachel, do you know anyone in the room? Why is Rachel here in the theater?
Now, you could obviously hear something. Mm-hmm. Something's coming. Now, when you were there, could you hear it a little better?
Yes. And for some reason, these clips get a little muddy when they're played over the radio.
Sure, absolutely.
They are more difficult to understand. But yes, there was a group of people with me, and everyone could hear the same thing coming through this live transmission. Now, I do not know anyone who's passed over named Rachel, so I really don't know who Rachel is. If we're talking to someone who's a dead person, uh-huh, or an entity who's using that name. The voices are tinny. They speak in a very clipped kind of odd way, almost robotic. When she says author, it's author, sort of like that.
Right.
And Rosemary is like very fast. Rosemary. And
do they seem to be trying to communicate with you, or are they just random sounds that some people, let's say, pick up when they just run their tape recorder?
Well, some people just run their recorders and their boxes and see what they get. But in these cases, I try and prompt a communication. I identify myself as the owner of the device, and that I'm present to establish communication. And I ask for communicators to come forward and identify themselves. Sometimes they do with a name, and sometimes they just start speaking. But as I mentioned earlier, none of them seem to last very long. They might say two or three things.
Sure.
And then maybe another communicator comes in. There's a feeling of an effort to bridge this gap, this barrier between dimensional realms.
Okay, let's listen to the next one, Danny.
Can you identify anyone in the room here? Do you know Joey? There is a Joey in the theater. You know Joey? It's him?
I guess what's so weird about these two, Rosemary, unless you're talking to someone who's got a ham radio somewhere, they do seem to be listening and reacting to you.
Yes, that's very true. Answers are quite often specific to the questions and to the people present. So it gets very difficult to rule out just sort of some random extraneous broadcast that you might be picking up that coincidentally matches the questions that you're asking.
All right, let's listen to the third one, Dan.
Just a lot of curiosity about this.
Sounds like an old Model T car trying to start, doesn't it?
Well, this is another location, and these are examples of how different the boxes can sound in environments. It depends on the radio stations in an area and also the physical locale. This last clip that we just heard is from the Mansfield Reformatory in Mansfield, Ohio, and I'm down in solitary confinement, way down in this granite basement, with a group of investigators, including a medium from Maryland and some members of Ghostly Talk Radio. And I didn't think I was going to get anything on my scan, and because it was just making this kind of odd whirring sound. And floating across the top of that scan is a male voice that says very clearly, it's dark, and we are sitting there in the dark.
Okay, let's listen to this last one. So what's that Model T sound? And because I could hear the voice behind it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that Model T sound is the only thing that I'm able to get over the scanning device, the mini box, down there in the basement. I can't get actual snippets of radio broadcast. It's just making almost this staticky.
But
kind
do you
of
hear
noise.
That while you're, I guess, recording it?
Yes.
You can hear it coming
now,
in. Okay.
Now, sometimes you get them almost like EVP. You don't hear it real time, but when you listen on playback like EVP, you do get voices. But with ITC, the whole idea of instrumental transcommunication is to get the communication live in real time, that you actually hear it. And the voice in that case comes right at the end of the clip, and it's another male voice saying, "The box is talking." I find this very interesting because the more I use these devices, the more communications I get that are box-specific. The communicators seem to know what these devices are, what they're for, and they get excited when they're around. It's like they have an opportunity now to open up the phone line, so to speak.
Yes. Now, what does this tell you then? The fact that, and let's now make the assumption that what you are getting are the sounds from the other side, okay? Or you're communicating with the other side. What does that tell you about how it exists and what it does?
Clearly, I think that there's the possibility of communication. This would, if we can prove this sort of communication, it would be very good evidence in favor of survival, and that there is survival of personality, and personality that can interact with the living and can communicate. These sorts of ideas have existed in our esoteric philosophies and our spiritual disciplines throughout human history. What we're trying to do now is get the empirical evidence to support these sorts of things. And I think that we're on the cutting edge of this very raw frontier now.
I think we are, too. Much like Ouija boards, which I no longer like, which could very well be a portal to the other side. But it's a form of communication, though, for something over there, too. Now, as you said earlier, we don't know what these are. We don't know if they're demons. We don't know if they're good entities. We don't know if they're ETs. We just don't know. Anything could come through on a box, too, right?
Anything could. In fact, critics of these raise some very valid points that people may be opening up portals that they have no idea what they're playing with, that could be dangerous, that could be inviting negative entities to have access to the world. I do believe in trickster entities, and I certainly see a good number of people in the course of my investigations who wind up having problems because they've opened up something that was more than they bargained for. So the hazards exist. All of us who have these devices have encountered negative entities through them, angry communicators, and I think we've pretty much all been cussed out in ways that you know it's not coming over the radio or somebody would be losing their license.
Okay, you've been doing this for a long time. Have you subjected yourself to the possibility that you could be taken over, you could be possessed, who knows what? How do you fight this off for yourself?
I've always seemed to have a very good buffer around me, and I think that that's purposeful because of the nature of the work I do. If I were easily derailed or unbalanced by this, I simply couldn't carry on. But that doesn't mean that I have an invulnerability, and I do try to be cautious and take precautions and not invite something negative, at least knowingly, in. But some people don't have very good boundaries, or they want thrill-seeking, and I think that there's potential for problems there. You can open up portals that are difficult to close. You can unwittingly invite something to come closer or communicate to you or through you that then becomes attached to you. Myself and other investigators in the field, we deal with these issues almost on a daily basis. Someone who's having problems because they just got into the deep end of the paranormal pool.
When I opted out of the Ouija board experiment, 95% of the emails and Fastblats that I got were pretty positive about that, about not doing it. But the 5% that wanted me to go through with it, man, they were determined. And, you know, there was even one group that says, "Doggone it, George, we're here. We've ordered pizza. We're ready to go and have a nice party, and you cancel this thing." And they were really upset. You're right. There are some that just want to have fun with this, but that's not always fun, is it?
It's not always fun. I think that you have to approach this with a lot of discernment and discretion and sometimes caution. For example, I don't feel comfortable doing this sort of communication device on a regular basis in my home. Other people do. My reasons are I'm in this work 24/7, and when I'm home, I don't want to be dealing with entities who are trying to communicate with me. I want a haven from that. If you run devices like this regularly in the same environment, I think that you are going to create openings that get bigger, stronger, and maybe more difficult to close. There are people in this field who prefer to do this work at home, and they say they don't seem to have a problem that way. I think it depends on the individual. But I go out there and do all this investigation and research where I have to open myself up to be receptive to things. And when I come home, I want to close down. I don't want to have to deal with things dropping in on me uninvited.
Have you ever had an experience that scared the heck out of you personally?
I've certainly encountered some negative entities. I would say the shadow people are the creepiest phenomena that I've ever come across. I have encountered malevolent entities that I would class as demonic. Mm-hmm. I've never encountered something that I would have to describe as absolute, ultimate, extreme, terrifying evil. The shadow people, however, generate a malevolence to them that is quite bone-chilling and terrifying.
Where do you think they're coming from?
I think that they are entities from another dimension who have a hostile agenda.
Hostile agenda.
A hostile agenda against us.
You don't think there's like a warp and they're out of kilter by a little bit? They don't intentionally try to come here, but somehow they are?
I think that they intentionally come here.
Okay.
There are dark figures that are more ghostly, and I think that they're different, and they may fall into that classification of, you know, a time-space warp where they just kind of slip in. But shadow people seem to be very intelligent and very deliberate about approaching human beings and generating a fear response in us that is so extreme that it prevents us from wanting to know too much about them. And I think that's part of their agenda.
You know, other than a mosquito being part of the food chain, I always wonder, what the heck is its real purpose? Why is it here? It passes on disease. It bites us. You know, maybe it's population control with these things. Who knows? The same, I guess you could say, about a shadow person. Why in the heck was it created?
I think they're shape-shifting entities. I found a link to them to ETs, and the avenue that I've been pursuing lately is the djinn. I don't know that all shadow people might be djinn, but certainly a lot of their behavior fits djinn behavior of wanting to find pathways into this world so that they can have a stronger presence in this world that would push human beings out, literally out of this world. They seem to be able to vampirize us in some way. They get into our heads, into our consciousness. They like to visit us while we sleep. I think that they are gleaning something from our consciousness through our emotions and mental thought patterns that might be giving them valuable information for how to anchor into this world. I think clearly if they could just come into this world, they would.
Sure.
But I think it's difficult for them to come in and hold space in this physical space. What their true form is, nobody knows. And I think that they either have to use this weird shadow man form, or maybe that's a form they have chosen to throw us off track.
How do we get rid of them?
It's very difficult sometimes. Prayer will work for some people. Sleeping with the lights on will. That seems to work the best. Getting angry at them will sometimes make them go away.
Really?
People have to experiment. It seems that the generation of electrical and electromagnetic fields disrupts their patterns. And I think that accounts for the lights, for leaving a radio or TV on. That seems to keep them away or prevents them from having a stronger presence.
We'll be back in a moment with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, her website, visionaryliving.com. Next hour, we'll talk about dreams right here on Coast to Coast AM.